From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's programme, are you still planning your Thanksgiving meal? Well, how about cooking something that is tailored for the art and design fans in your life?
Maybe you want to make a Robert Rauschenberger, have a kind of flatbed picture plane of a hamburger on focaccia, and everyone can add their own toppings and have it be a kind of communal enterprise. And maybe that would be a really interesting new tradition to start.
Hear from conceptual artist and cook Esther Choi. And we're going to learn about the subconscious messages behind those car colours at the LA Auto Show. That's all coming up. First up, though, it has been a time of loss in LA architecture. This past Saturday, Dion Neutra, son of the hugely influential early modernist architect Richard Neutra, well, he passed. Dion had spent decades preserving his father's legacy. And then there was Ray Cappy, who died Thursday at age 92. Ray Cappy was the architect of stunning houses and other buildings, who also founded a highly original school. He was concerned with environmentalism before most people had heard the term. He also saw his career get eclipsed by a feisty younger generation, and then he made a comeback that kept him busy until the end of his life. Today, we're going to hear about that life.
Ray Cappy is, to me, one of the more influential, most influential Southern California architects.
This is Joe Addo. He was co-founder of the A plus D Museum, which mounted an exhibition of Cappy's work back in 2004.
He's carried on the tradition of the experimental Southern California architecture through the works of people like Craig Elwood and Schindler and Neutra into, I think, its most refined contemporary expression. And to me, Ray has been able to synthesize all these ideals into a working, livable architecture. And obviously, we know Ray as a great educator.
Ray Cappy was born in Minneapolis. He studied at Berkeley. He moved to LA and he started his own firm in Santa Monica in 1953. He went on to design over 100 homes, many post and beam, inside, outside and open plan in the California modern tradition. In 1962, he and his wife Shelley bought a steep lot in Rustic Canyon for $17,000, the LA Times reports, because it had been deemed unbuildable. And he commenced work on his masterpiece, a 4,000-square-foot house for his family, an amazing composition of split-levelled, open-plan floors with flying staircases and views up, down and out, all built in wood, concrete and glass and supported on six concrete towers over a small stream. While working on designs like this, he was busy teaching, and that led to a project that would change the course of LA architecture. Todd Gannon was a professor at SIARC, and he curated an exhibition about that period.
In 1969, he went to teach at Cal Poly Pomona and soon had a kind of disagreement, let's say, with the leadership of the school, which caused him to leave the school with several faculty and about 25 students joining him to form SIARC in a warehouse in Santa Monica in 1972.
SIARC is short for the Southern California Institute of Architecture, and also Science and Architecture. The school is now located in the Arts District. Numerous designers of note have come through SIARC's doors. One of them was the Japanese architect Shigeru Ban, who presented his work to Cappy when he could barely speak a word of English and he was admitted on the spot. At a talk in 2009, Ray Cappy said the following.
That was one of my better moments. I had many like that because I really didn't believe in the, you know, this elitist system of worrying about what the GPA was and what the SAT scores were and so forth. I think in architecture, the portfolios speak for the person.
Back to Todd Gannon.
Well, I think Ray had a very interesting attitude. He was someone who felt that students should really lead the organization of their curriculum, let's say. And when SIARC began, it actually had no curriculum. This turned out to be a bit of a problem. You know, Ray was a very demanding person. He was very soft-spoken and I think very humble, but also I think he had very clear ideas of what he expected. And it was really in the late 1970s when a kind of tension had really emerged between the generation of people like Eric Moss, Tom Main, Michael Rotundi, Coy Howard, who really formed a kind of core younger faculty coalition, let's call it, and Ray's generation.
That's Todd Gannon. He's head of the architecture section at the Knowlton School at Ohio State University. He was a professor at SciArc. I'm Frances Anderton. This is DNA, and we're talking about the late Ray Cappy. Now, one of the renegade young teachers who left Pomona to work at SciArc with Ray Cappy was Tom Main. You might know his dramatic Caltrans headquarters in downtown Los Angeles. He has built around the world and won numerous accolades. Ray, he says, was like a father to him.
He affected and helped form a lot of young people, certainly me. Now, I have no idea what I would have done. I'm 26 years old, and I'm 27. We're starting SciArc, and it completely shaped or reshaped or shifted my whole life and gave me opportunities and kind of conditions I could have never imagined. He was able to develop an institution that was researching and innovating kind of state-of-the-art ideas of what architecture is, and could tolerate and could promote huge differences. And it's even more interesting because it was not easy for him, because he was, we used to have really fierce fights. Next morning, have breakfast, sit down, work it out, talk about it. And we were close, dear, dear friends.
He has a very open idea about how to educate, let people follow their own paths of exploration. But he's fairly, is doctrinaire the right word? I mean, he's got a fairly fixed idea about what is the right kind of architecture, at least as he produces it. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. It's a really complicated subject, number one, because absolutely he had a very clear idea of what architecture was. He represents the end of an era.
And the California modernism era.
Exactly. And again, he's working with young people that are all kind of attacking that era. And it wasn't simple. It wasn't easy for him, I'm sure, while watching the next generation and nurturing this group of people, which was my generation.
That was Tom Main, and we're talking about Ray Cappy. So for a while, Cappy's work fell out of favor along with the rest of California's modernist houses, and he settled into a semi-retirement. Then he got a knock on his door from Yassi Vafai. She's an architect based in Venice who had studied at SciArc.
I loved Ray's work, and just driving around Santa Monica Canyon, I always wanted to go inside. So I found the courage to go knock on the door, and Shelley warmly accepted me and gave me a tour of the house. And I asked Ray if I could work for him, and he said that he's retired. And he said, "Can't you see I'm nearly retired?" And I said, "Great men never retire. I'm never going to let you retire, Ray." And between Shelley and I, so we went to Ray's house and gathered the drawings, all of the hand-drawn working drawings, and I inked over them. Now, this was the early 90s, and the digital age was just starting. But I had no intention of doing so. And then we put some tours together. And not only myself, but nobody really wanted to leave the buildings. And Ray's work was very memorable in a way that even when you would leave the building, it sort of evoked this sense of being part of the building. So the building became part of your skin.
That's Yassi Vafai. Now, starting around the time she worked with Ray, there was a revival of interest in California modernism, and Ray's work came steaming back into focus. It even made it onto a TV series. Just listen to this clip from an episode of Californication.
Oh, my God.
You like?
Well, yeah, of course I like. It's a Ray Cappy house.
Ray Cappy. That's one of those guys from architecture school. They used to get you all juiced up.
One person who had loved Ray's houses since childhood was software developer Steve Glenn. He's now CEO of Plant Prefab. In the early aughts, he was dreaming up a concept for prefab modular modern homes that he called living homes.
And I knew that I had a thesis for the business, focus on people who, like me, really value design, health, and sustainability. And we were going to work with great architects, and we're going to integrate an extremely comprehensive environmental program where we're going to use prefabrication to more efficiently build our home. So that was the thesis behind the business, and I was working on the business plan. And as I was doing this, this is 2004, I think, a home that he designed down the street from his own, came up for sale. It was the Katzenstein house. I met Ray at an open house, and I started talking to him about the fact that we're going to focus on modern design and sustainable design and healthy design. And so Ray starts talking about how he had been doing environmentally efficient architecture in the 70s and how he started working with prefab in the 70s. And I didn't know this about his career. And I was just completely blown away. And I said, hey, would you be interested in working with me on this? And he said he was. And so that's how it began.
That was Steve Glenn, CEO of Plant Prefab and founder of Living Homes. The first living home, designed by Ray, became the first home ever to receive a LEED for Home Platinum rating. Now, at the event at Hammer, Ray talked about how this project continued ideas that he had been playing with and sharing with students for years.
I remember one of our first projects at SIARC, or just before we came to SIARC from Cal Poly, was a project in first year in which they were supposed to build these structures from plywood and waste no plywood whatsoever. And so they came up with the rhombic dodecahedron as a form that wasted none of it and created these environments. And so very early we were talking that way.
That was Ray Cappy. He died Thursday at age 92, leaving Shelley, his wife of 69 years, and his children Ron, Finn and Karen, and several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. To conclude our story, we reached out to Hernan Diaz-Alonso. He is the current director of SIARC, and he will continue the school without Ray there to help guide it.
He set up the school as a place for disagreement and as a place for new ideas. Science, architecture, SIARC being a place for openness, SIARC being a laboratory, SIARC being a place for dissent is not only tolerated but encouraged. Is a place to keep looking always on the new possibilities for innovation. What is the role of architecture in society and how society change? So in a way, yes, the school is very different than what it was. It's much more institutionalized and organized. But at the same time, that rebel fighter-ship spirit is very much there.
That was Hernan Diaz-Alonso. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, if you go to the auto show this holiday, just know that the colours are chosen to communicate powerful, if subliminal, messages.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Go to the LA Auto Show at the Convention Center, and of course all the cars will be vivid colours. But what do those colours, known as communication colours, mean?
As car designers, we try to communicate also certain segments, and a colour is a great tool for that.
This is Sabine Lapine. She advises car companies on their colour, materials and finish. And she told us how colours even signal a car's fuel usage.
So if you look into, for example, fast cars and see the exterior colors for those. You use for Ferraris or Lamborghinis, or Mustang has it. Like, you use bright reds or oranges to communicate that it's a fast car. And then if you introduce a new technology, you would want to also express that within a exterior color. And very common is to use either a very light airy blue or a very clean white, because these colors communicate purity, clean, futuristic image.
That's for a hybrid or a all-electric car.
Exactly. New drivetrains are usually using that.
So then if you're making a car that's still 100% gas-dependent, gas-fueled, you'll see perhaps darker colours or denser colours?
I'm talking about communication colours. Of course, the car companies offer a a wider palette for their production models. But if you want to communicate a certain lifestyle, color is a great way to express that. So yeah, black is for luxury, gray is contemporary.
So there's a very interesting car at the auto show this year, and that is a hybrid of a gas guzzler meeting an all-electric, and that is the Ford Mustang Mach-E. And that's been presented in this very strong, powerful, but sky blue colour. So what's going on there? Is it blue for pure and yet dense and powerful for gas guzzler?
I wasn't working on that project, but I think it's a very smart way to tie in the new drivetrain, but still with a faster color because it's a Mustang. It has the Mustang logo in the front because they used the Grabber Blue, which is a vintage color. It's an iconic color. It was used for the GT Performance Edition, I think, on stage. And I thought personally that was a very smart move because since it is very controversial for them to introduce even a car like that, this is a great way to tie in a more educated customer group who would know, you know, the history of the brand. And I think it's a great move to use this color. And it's at the same time, I would call it, it's so bright. It's an electric blue almost. So it does represent the drivetrain as well.
And what is the name of the blue? Just say it again.
Grabber Blue.
Grabber. G-R-A-B-B-E-R.
Exactly.
Because it grabs your attention.
Yes, pretty much.
Huh. So what other car or color grabbed your attention at the auto show this year?
I still like the Taycan, the Porsche Taycan, representing a new technology. And they have the Taycan white is such a pure white. And a lot of times people who are not in the color industry, they probably wouldn't notice, is it white? You know, white is not white. And if you've ever painted an interior in your house white, you go to, you know, the paint companies, Sherwin-Williams or Dunn Edwards, and you get your paint chips. And then you see, oh, it's yellowish, it's warm, it's cool. And the Taycan white I love because it's a very clean but still grayish white. It's almost in between white and gray. And to me, with the shape of the car, it represents a very modern, you know, it's a very great way to represent this new technology. And so that's, you know, something you just probably would walk by, but it has a deep meaning to use several shades of white or light blue.
Got it. Now let's talk about the other car that made waves at the LA Auto Show this year, and that is Elon Musk's Tesla Cybertruck, his new all-electric pickup truck. At least that's what he's referring to it as, although looking at it, it seems to have the kind of aggression and angularity of a stealth bomber.
Yeah, yes. It's probably the most, to me, it's the most exciting car that I've seen this year because I don't want to dismiss anybody's work necessarily, but if you look at the car, like in general, the car industry today, it is very cut and paste and very, there's not big changes. And, you know, working in the automotive industry, I know how hard it is because there's financial restrictions. You have to design to cost, where I guess Tesla, Elon Musk, he has a different view, right? He puts out controversial design for a reason. And I love that as a designer because do I like it? I'm not even sure yet, but I think it's exciting because it's different and it's polarizing. And you're, normally as a designer, as a car designer, you are told not to do anything polarizing. So you have to please a wide customer group. And that's why I just love that truck.
Did you love its color? What was its color?
Well, it was steel. It was, it was the metal itself. So they used what we would call an honest color theme. They just used the color of the metal. It does come, I did some research, supposedly it comes in a black matte, so they have different finishes for it planned. But at that point, it was pretty much the pure metal. And that's something admirable as a designer. And taste and preference is something different. But I admire that they just carried it through as is.
That was Sabine Lapine. She advises car companies on the color, materials and finish of their luxury cars. This is DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Are you looking for Thanksgiving menu ideas for the design and architecture fans in your life? How about taking a page from a new art project that comes in the guise of a cookbook? And that cookbook is called Le Corbusier, Edible Art and Design Classics. Le Corbusier obviously references Le Corbusier, the Swiss-French architect and one of the fathers of modernism. The cookbook is by Esther Choi. She's an artist and a scholar, and she got the idea during a research project in London when she came across a menu for a farewell dinner in 1937 for the founder of the Bauhaus School, Walter Gropius.
And it really caught my eye because, having been to many different archives, the menu actually sort of said more about Gropius' stature and his kind of relationships in the kind of cultural scene in London at the time than a lot of other types of documentation that you'd come across in an archive would. And so you see Gropius enjoying, you know, salmon and lobster sauce and having like a 4 or 5 course meal during a time of rations in London.
Choi was inspired by this menu, and she went home to New York and she threw a dinner party. She gave the dishes punny names after famous artists, designers, and architects. It was inspired by the late 60s art movement that emphasized artistic process over the finished product.
So it was a kind of gathering, a kind of very Fluxus-inspired 60s happening for people just would show up to my apartment in Brooklyn. And it just became an opportunity for us to enjoy food together, but sort of laugh at the pretension of all these things that we basically spend a lot of time studying or curating or promoting in some way. And it was quite low key and it didn't have an invitation, but I thought it'd be really funny to have dishes like, you know, can you pass the flan flavin? You know, a kind of like...
As in Dan Flavin.
Exactly. So this sort of went on for a couple of years. And then I was approached by my publisher, Prestel. You know, would I be interested in putting a publication together based on these events? I really, being this like highfalutin academic at the time, thought that, okay, this is going to be some kind of, you know, theoretical treatise with, you know, it's going to be so heavily researched and footnoted. And then my editor came back to me and said, no, actually, we were thinking about a cookbook. So I thought maybe actually I can start to think about appropriating the conventions of cookbook publishing as a way to try to work through some of the things that I was wrestling with. I was also trying to actively push against representations of food in food culture today. And so the pictures even, like the photographs that I've taken of the food, is entirely imperfect. And that was just something I had to accept, you know, just as a reality of sort of my own skill set at being a home cook and not a trained chef.
But let's talk about some of the recipes. So if we open up to your first section, it starts with the Mies van der Rohe dip, the great father of modernism, Mies van der Rohe. We go to De La Scofidio, Renfro pickles, De La Scofidio, Renfro, the designers of the Broad Museum, Florence Knoll rolls, Florence and Olive Knoll, the preeminent furniture company, Chris Burden shooters, LA artist, the late Chris Burden, Raymond Pettibone broth artist, John McCracker's artist, Ellsworth Kelly, tomato jelly. And we end with LA artist and designer Jorge Pardo whipped lardo. Tell us about that.
So Jorge Pardo's work is particularly interesting to me because of its intersection between art and design. So what I thought was really fascinating about Jorge Pardo is how in his work, a lamp is not necessarily merely a lamp, or a tile is not merely a tile. So I thought it might be interesting if we think about lardo in the same way. So if you think about fat and like the role of fat, we tend to think about fat and utility in a certain way. We use it to grease a pan. We use it as a kind of carrier for some, you know, some other thing. But what happens when that very utilitarian substance like fat becomes the actual main part of the dish? So lardo in this instance is like basically kind of created into this really lovely kind of you know, substitute kind of butter. It's like the best butter you've ever had, basically. And so really it's just a handful of like four ingredients that you whip together, and you just have time on your side and you just whip it into this lovely, fluffy, delectable spread.
I love some of your names: Rhubarbara Kruger Compote, Quiche Herring, Denise Scott Brownies, Michael Heitzer Levitated Mass Pavlova. They're great. Oh, let's try the Shigeru Banchan two ways. We're in vegetables. Shigeru Ban being the Japanese architect.
So Shigeru Ban's work is really interesting to me because he is an example of an architect that privileges resourcefulness over resources. And the fact that he's been able to use cardboard tubes in so many ways, structurally, formally, like, you know, he can do so many things with it. A lot of Korean food is very simple and it doesn't cost a lot to make, you know, and that's part of the ethos of Korean food. So I took the humble cucumber as my cardboard tube to talk about all the ways in which you could start to rethink cooking cucumbers in ways that are kind of unexpected. So banchan are Korean sort of side dishes that are communally shared. And so you'll typically see them in the middle of a table shared by everyone. So basically there's two ways of preparing it. One is kind of classic Korean cucumber, spicy cucumber salad. And then the other one is a little bit kind of more unusual, where you stir fry the cucumbers and it creates a completely different texture, a completely different kind of palette. You know, it's a kind of really amazing, I think, really interesting way of thinking about how to use a really basic ingredient and transforming it completely.
Could you imagine applying this, I guess, conceptual framework that you've just been outlining to a Thanksgiving meal?
I wholeheartedly stand by this book as a Thanksgiving repertoire for this reason. And I digress a little bit by giving you some biographical information, but my family's story is all about migration. So we joke about how people get picked up on the way and then like people marry, you know, marry other people and then the family keeps growing. And it's just like a very eclectic group of human beings in my family. So for that reason, anytime we had Thanksgiving or Christmas, the buffet spread was very confusing as a child. So you'd have lasagna, kimchi, mango salad. You had to get very creative about what combinations of food could basically share real estate on the plate. I think in that sense, if you were coming over to my family's house for Thanksgiving, having a very eclectic mix of food on the table would not in any way be abnormal. So in that level, I think Le Corbusier Buffet could work. But many of the recipes really ask for you to rethink sharing practices. So for example, there's a yokonominaki. So it's an okonomiyaki cabbage pancake, Japanese cabbage pancake named after Yoko Ono. And so I sort of ask people to snip pieces of this pancake. It's inspired by her piece called Cut Piece, where people would snip garments of her clothing off of her as a way to think about how much one is willing to give someone else, right? Whereas her piece, her performance was about how much one keeps, because you could cut a piece of her clothing and then take it away with you. So a lot of these recipes actually start to, you know, activate questions around the politics of sharing. And I think, you know, Thanksgiving is the perfect opportunity to start asking those questions and also maybe like develop new kind of habits and customs. So maybe you want to make a Robert Rauschenberger, have a kind of flatbed picture plane of a hamburger on focaccia, and everyone can add their own toppings and have it be a kind of communal enterprise. And maybe that would be a really interesting new tradition to start. I don't know.
That's Esther Choi, author of a new cookbook entitled Le Corbusier, Edible Art and Design Classics. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. Avishai Artsy produced and edited this program with a final mix by Ray Guana. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.